Before introducing my next guest to you, I have to give you, in the interest of full disclosure, a kind of a disclaimer. This man made my brother's life really good for a few years. Because when Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor, my brother Seth was a special assistant to the Secretary of Labor in Washington, D.C. during the Clinton administration. And Secretary Reich left just shortly after Bill Clinton's second inauguration, went back into the world of academia. He is now the professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and is also the author of a new book called Super Capitalism: The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, how are you, Paul?
I'm doing just fine. Nice to have you on here.
Well, it's good to have you, and I wish we could talk about Seth, but I'm not sure all your listeners would be all that much, all that interested in your brother. I am.
He was a pain in the butt to have as an employee, wasn't he?
No, actually, he was terrific.
If it wasn't the Department of Labor, you would have fired him.
No, he was great. And you give him my best, will you?
I certainly will. Let's talk a little bit about these recent developments that certainly affected thousands of people here in the St. Louis area and millions across the country with the recent strike just ended early this morning with the UAW and GM. We certainly have talked about it a lot here on this show, and it really goes to a lot of issues relating to unions and American employees in the workplace, particularly when it comes to those twin third rail issues of health care and pensions. What's your take on all of this?
Well, it's going to be very hard for GM to continue because, at the present rate it's going, because as I understand the direction that those negotiations are taking, the UAW doesn't want to give away much job security and much wages or health care benefits. The problem is that GM is in direct competition with Toyota and other car makers, particularly Japanese makers in the United States, who are not offering the same degree of job security or wages or health care that GM is offering. Well, it's a competitive marketplace. Consumers are going to choose the best deal. And the reality is that that's super capitalism. I mean, consumers now have the opportunity to get terrific deals. 40 years ago, there was just the big three. Consumers had to take whatever the big three offered, and the big three were all unionized. That's not the case today.
You know, it's interesting whenever we get into discussions of consumers, and I think this is one of the basic theses of your book, it seems like people may talk about things that are important to them, but the only thing that's really important to them is the bottom line. How much does it cost? Where can I get it for the cheapest? And I don't necessarily want a cheap product. I just want something that's not going to cost me a lot. Is that what you're talking about here in super capitalism?
Yeah, that's right, Paul. I mean, a lot of us care about the wages of everybody else, our children, our friends, our acquaintances, people in our community. We're concerned as citizens about global warming, maybe. We're concerned about health and safety. And we have a lot of concerns as citizens. But when it comes down to actually purchasing a car or purchasing a flat-screen TV or purchasing whatever we are purchasing, we want the best deal. And that means the best value, the best quality for the price, the lowest price. And that's going to drive down wages in a global economy, in an economy where you've got non-unionized workers working for companies like Toyota producing very good cars.
So whose fault is it then? Is it the consumer's fault or the corporation's fault?
Well, instead of talking about fault, what we have to really understand is there's some choices to be made here. I mean, we could, as a nation, we could pass a law saying every company has to be unionized. I would not necessarily support that law. But if we did, we would create a level playing field so that Toyota was unionized and had to provide its workers with the same benefits and health care and everything else that the GM provides. Or we could have a law that raised the wages of everybody. We'd pay for it as consumers, just like we'd pay for the first law. Everybody can join a union and every company has got to be unionized. That would increase the costs to all of us as consumers. The question is, like everything else, is it worth it? That's what we have democracy to decide. If we have a law that says we have to pay more to avoid global warming, because all of our gas is going to cost more. Is that worth it to us? As consumers, we might say no. As citizens, we might say, well, maybe I'm willing to make that sacrifice.
You say in the book that, in essence, capitalism in the United States is stronger than ever, but democracy is weaker. What do you mean by that?
Well, most people today, when asked, do you think that democracy and our political process is working for you or for the special interests, most people say, oh, no, it's the special interests, it's the big guys. Now, the same question asked 35 years ago, interestingly, Paul, most people say, no, it's working for me. It's working very well. And it's not just polls. I mean, just look at the degree of money and lobbying. When I went to Washington for the first time in 1974 in the Ford administration, there were 7,000 lobbyists in Washington, and Washington was kind of a seedy place. When I went back there in the 1990s working for Bill Clinton, there were 35,000 lobbyists, and Washington was rich. The five counties surrounding metropolitan Washington were five of the richest 20 counties in the United States. You know, all that money, most of it coming from corporations, has made it difficult for citizens to get any kind of a voice.
You know, I talk about this often, particularly when I've talked about problems with big pharma and other mega industries in this country and globally, in fact, that they do have so many lobbyists in Washington. And, of course, we're supposed to have 535 people elected to office there in the Congress of the United States who are supposed to be working for us. But more often than not, they're actually taking meetings with these lobbyists who are helping them write regulations and legislation that is not really going to help the American public, the citizenry of this country, but rather to work on competition inside their own industries, right?
Yeah, most of the time it's one company hiring lobbyists to help them against another company. It's the same sort of super capitalism, but it's now in the political sphere. And the only way we're going to get around that, I mean, let's face it, candidates now, you know, need bigger and bigger war chests because they do a lot of advertising, and advertising costs money. And the only way we're going to get around that is if we reform the political system, whether it is public financing of elections, or it is shortening the duration of elections, or it's having a lockbox, a kind of a blind trust, so that anybody can contribute as much as they want to any candidate of their choice. The trouble is the candidates cannot know who contributed what if it's a blind trust. Maybe that would sever the link between money and getting favors from that money. A lot of things we can do, Paul, but it's not going to reform itself, this system, from the inside.
But realistically, I mean, those are things that we could do. But we're not going to do that, are we?
Well, it depends on who we is. I mean, if you're talking about citizens who are outraged, have had enough of a democracy that's a fake democracy in many respects, it's not responding to what we want, what we need as citizens, I think we could have a lot of impact. One thing that I learned as Bill Clinton's Secretary of Labor is that nothing good happens in Washington unless people there who are elected to office have to make something good happen. You know, if it's just the status quo, it's going to be special interests arguing for favors for themselves.
Robert Reich's new book is called Super Capitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life, and co-star of one of the funniest bits ever on Late Night with Conan O'Brien last year when you two were a detective duo in a promo for a buddy cop movie. I don't recall the name of the movie. But
I don't either, and we never made it.
We
thought that we would attract a lot of studios. I mean, here we were, available.
Yeah.
We even had the trailer. But it never happened.
The long and the short of it, something like that?
Long and the short of it. I thought that was a good title.
That would have been it. We're talking about the super capitalism here. I'm surprised to read that you think that the corporate social responsibility movement is distracting and counterproductive. And I'm going to quote you from page 205 of Super Capitalism, where you talk about an earthquake that hit Pakistan in October 2005 and killed more than 87,000 people and displaced three times as many as those affected by the Indian Ocean tsunami. Yet the Bush administration initially pledged only $500,000 in aid, a sum so small as to be derided by many Pakistanis, and then Bush pledged more, and also asked five prominent CEOs to mount a major fundraising effort from American corporations. GE contributed more than $5 million in cash and health care and energy equipment, Pfizer $1 million to relief agencies and $5 million in medicine and health care products, Xerox $1 million in cash, Citigroup $3 million. In total, the CEOs raised about $100 million, moving the president to another effusive outpouring of gratitude about how the international community had stepped up. If they hadn't, the door might have been opened for more radical Islamic influences. You disagree with that, though?
Yes, I certainly do disagree. I think corporate social responsibility is mostly just public relations. Under super capitalism, Paul, companies can't sacrifice investor returns or even consumer, good deals without hurting themselves.
But why is it bad for a company to step up and say, you know what, we're going to give $1 million for this, or $5 million for that, or $10 million for this?
It's fine if it, it's real, if it helps the bottom line because it's good public relations. But if it doesn't help the bottom line, what right do executives have to take shareholder money and decide what good things they're going to do with it? I mean, shareholders, if they want to be charitable, they could be charitable at home. Why invest in a company that's going to be not return a high investment, but be charitable? I don't know that I want to give the right to decide the meaning of charity to unelected and unaccountable CEOs.
So you would have the CEOs who were in charge of those companies not make these decisions and not make those donations, not only to tragic events like that, but to all sorts of other things that they fund in this country?
Well, I don't think that they have any license to do that. Under super capitalism, they don't really have much discretion anyway. I mean, look, competition is so intense that if a CEO were to say, well, I think I want to invest my shareholders' money in this and this and this, and it may require that the shareholders get a slightly less return on their investment, but I think it's a good thing in my heart. Shareholders are just going to take their money and go someplace else where they don't have to sacrifice. Why should a shareholder put money in some company and subscribe to the CEO's own wish list of good things?
What about companies that are trying to turn green now, whether they believe in the fight against global warming or not? Even Rupert Murdoch lately has been talking about News Corp trying to do things that would be better for the environment. Or do you think that they're doing that because they think in the long run it will accrue to their own bottom line?
Well, obviously it accrues to their bottom line. And it's also kind of a public relations distraction. A lot of the American public is led to believe that corporations are doing these wonderful things for the environment and wonderful things for this and that, and therefore the pressure is off to set laws and rules that say to companies, look, you've got to reduce your CO2 emissions. This is serious. It's kind of a political ploy in many cases. I mean, we got, some big manufacturers of food processors who are selling sugary junk to kids. They see legislation on the horizon that may reduce their ability to advertise all that sugary stuff to kids, and they say, okay, we're going to voluntarily be good citizens. We really believe in corporate social responsibility, so we're going to reduce our advertising of all of this sugary stuff directed at kids, and therefore we don't need legislation. Well, it may be smoke and mirrors. It may be that they're doing just the minimum they can possibly do to call off and to forestall legislation, convince the public that they're actually serious about this problem. But it's all for the cameras.
I agree with you that the companies are doing that to forestall the legislation and to get a little publicity. I'd rather see fights like that go back to who's responsible for putting the sugar in the kid's mouth in the first place and talk about parental responsibility.
Well, you could talk about every kind of responsibility. It's parental responsibility, but it's also the responsibility of the... I mean, look at the advertising budgets of food, junky stuff directed at kids. I mean, yes, parents have a responsibility, but why allow all that advertising directed at kids? I mean, look, we could talk about global warming. We could talk about junk foods to kids. We can talk about any number of ways in which we want companies to be more responsible. But it takes laws. It takes rules. Otherwise, companies are going to do whatever is most profitable.
But I'm a little confused now, Bob, because we're talking about marketplace on one side and regulation on the other side. And we discussed earlier the influence that lobbyists have on regulation and how the regulation really is set in Washington more on a competitive basis rather than a what's good for the country basis. Does the marketplace balance that out at all?
I don't think so, Paul. That's why we've got to rescue democracy from the clutches of big corporations. You know, small businesses and average citizens have very little to say in our democracy, and it's now run more than ever before by the really biggest corporations, global corporations. Well, look, we don't have a hope of setting the rules of the game. In terms of global warming, junk cereals, sugar, anything else you want companies to do, you know, provide health care for employees, make it easier or less easy to form unions, whatever your political views are, I'm not going to take them on right now. The most important thing, and I think people agree with me on this, is we got to get money out of politics, particularly all of that corporate money out of politics, and make politics and democracy work for us again.
News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with former Secretary of Labor Bob Reich about his new book, Super Capitalism. You can also find him on log, especially look for his blog and his video log, where you'll find out details of his life, like him dating Hillary Clinton when they were in college together. True?
Well, actually, I didn't date her. But I suppose you could have said it was sort of a date. I was president of my sophomore class. She was president of her freshman class in college. We had a kind of presidential summit, we called it. Maybe it was an excuse for a date. We went to see Antonioni's film Blow Up.
Oh, that's a good one.
And I also remember she wanted a lot of sugar, a lot of popcorn, a lot of butter on her popcorn. And
you thought there should be regulations prohibiting that?
There were no regulations prohibiting that. Junk food flowed easily in those days, and that's all I remember. I mean, it wasn't a big deal until apparently somebody published some letters from her during her college years, and she said she had met a boy from Dartmouth, and she had gone up there, and she actually was rather pleasantly positive about this boy from Dartmouth.
Since you know both of the Clintons for so many years, are you working on her campaign?
I'm not. I'm really, at this point, helping anybody who asks me for help. And so far, Obama and Edwards have both asked me for policy guidance, and I'm happy to provide policy. You know, I'll even give up policy guidance to Fred Thompson if he asks. I mean, I'm a public utility here.
Now, how does that play in Clinton world?
Well, if I'm delighted. I mean, if she wants me to help, I would be delighted to help. I mean, I think every candidate, I happen to be a Democrat. Not all your listeners are Democrats. I happen to be a Democrat. I think that if we could take Hillary Clinton's experience and Obama's charisma, his ability to get young people engaged in politics, and take Edwards' policies and put them all together, we would have a fabulous candidate.
How's the Department of Labor doing since you left?
I haven't heard a word. I mean, it's gone dead. I think they turned out the lights.
Seriously?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't heard a single word.
You haven't seen any of the things that you did tried to be reversed or anything?
Oh, yes, there's been some of that. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we did, that your brother helped me do, some of that has been reversed. But other than that, I haven't seen very much.
I want to go back to something we were talking about here at the beginning of the hour, particularly in relation to the recent UAW strike and also employees in this country. And that is the matter of health care and jobs and all of those issues. There was a time when you and I were growing up, Bob, that if you took a job, you kept that job for a long time and the company took care of you. You got all sorts of benefits. You got health care insurance through your company. Those times are gone now. We have the police officers union here in St. Louis that is fighting for these kind of issues. And we've got auto workers and teachers and others who are fighting over those. Has there been a sea change when it comes to what an employee in America should expect now from their employer?
Yes, and the sea change is intensifying competition between companies, super capitalism, that's what I write about in the book, and it means that job stability is gone. Getting health care through your employers, well, you can hope for it, But a lot of low-paid people don't get it. And even if you're middle class, chances are you're paying through the nose these days for copayments and deductibles and premiums. The employer maybe pays a little bit, but the employer is paying less and less. Same thing with pensions. You know, in the old days, there was a monthly pension. You retired, and that employer provided you with a fixed amount of money every month. Well, those days are gone. Now you're lucky if you get a 401k plan, and you've got to put a lot of money in. Maybe the employer matches $1 for every $3 you put in. But look, intensifying competition, which means consumers, we as consumers and investors are getting greater and greater and better deals. Where do we think the great deals come from?
Mm-hmm.
They come from pushing wages down, getting rid of health care, pushing pension costs down, doing everything. We are the ones, in a way, as consumers and investors, we're the ones who are actually pushing companies to do all this.
When we see those jobs being outsourced or sometimes just moved out of the country completely, corporations picking up and leaving, that comes back to us, you think?
I think it does. I mean, look, at Walmart, I don't happen to agree with Walmart's employer practices. I don't like the fact that they pay such low wages, don't give health benefits, fight unions. But the fact is, Walmart provides great deals in terms of low costs and low prices to a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have access and need to have their dollars stretched as far as those dollars can go. Now, when you shop at Walmart, do you ask yourself, well, where do these good deals come from? They come from outsourcing. They come from maybe young children working 6 days a week in factories in Southeast Asia. They come from American employers pushing wages down, fighting unions. They come from all sorts of things that we may not like, but we want good deals.
Mm-hmm. And that's the capitalism that makes up the super capitalism that is the title of Bob Reich's new book, Super Capitalism, the Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. A real pleasure talking to you, Bob. Thanks for your time today.
It's been great talking to you, too. You take care.
Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.